So I do think the study of Jose is really elegantly positioned for us right now in this spring. It's nice, like, coming on the heels of Daniel, which was all about being in exile. And so here we are in this other book, also about exile, sort of the impetus for it, the restoration from it, all that kind of thing. And then also, like, with our marriage conference coming in February, I think to be talking about these things sort of makes that poignant in an interesting kind of way. Okay, so I want to be very clear. I have never been to prison, like orange jumpsuit, face tattoo, prison, but I did go to jail one time, and so I'm going to tell you about that. Around our house, kind of when I do things that are forgetful or like not being a very good adult, I get called sometimes affectionately Old Beth, because Old Beth was really different. I mean, kind of different. I did have some friends that recently reminded me of, like, this is not that long ago when I forgot to go to my own birthday dinner. Like, they're sitting at the restaurant with cards and things and call me, and I'm just, like, sitting on the couch and just forgot. And I just kind of do those sort of things. But when I was younger, like, this was really bad, and it got me into a lot of trouble, like, really often. And so, like, Old Beth... Didn't wear a seatbelt because I did not want the man restraining me, like Old Beth. I hitchhiked around Honduras for a year. Old Beth, like, lost her purse constantly, got her car towed constantly because I thought that I could park wherever I wanted to park. I just didn't really understand that rule, and I had things to do. Old Beth, like... It was just, like, thing after thing like this, and I know that my parents must have, like, wanted to strangle me, and sometimes I wanted to strangle me, but I just kept on doing these kind of things. And then, like, to our point here, one time I got arrested for a pretty, like, mundane reason. I was always late, and so everywhere I went, I was speeding and running stop signs all the time, and so I got tickets all the time. And so I got a ticket one time, and I said to myself, I was like, they can't keep up with all these tickets. Like, what are they really going to do to me if I don't pay this? I'm just going to, like, not pay it and see what happens. And so what they do is they send an officer to your house. But I was in college at the time, and my roommates and I had moved to a different complex, and so I wasn't there anymore. And so, like, in my mind, I was like, yeah, this works, you know, I got away with it. And so what they do then is they put a warrant out for your arrest. And so naturally, like, I got pulled over again for running a stop sign, and they, you know, pulled up my information in the cop car and stuff and saw that they had the warrant. And so, even if you say, like, yes, sir, and no, sir, like, they still don't let you go. And so they, you know, pulled me out of my car, and I'm standing on the side of the road, and, you know, put the handcuffs on me and stuff, and it was very, very sad. You know, I was crying these big tears, and it's extra sad because I couldn't wipe the tears away on account of the handcuffs. And so they put me in the cop car, and he's talking to me, and they kind of had, like, I don't know if all cities do this, but they had, like, a script of questions. And so they're asking me, you know, like, when is the last time you did LSD? When is the last time you ate hallucinogenic mushrooms? When is the last time you sold heroin? And all these questions. And I just started, like, laughing about this. The officer did not think that he didn't see the humor in it, and was, like, suspicious of me and things. And so, like, all the stuff went down. They towed my car, and it was finals week, and so all my books were in my car, and it was just, like, this, like, domino effect of horrible, horrible. They took me to the jail, and they searched me, and they did all these things, and my roommate came and bailed me out later that night. But, like, I tell all this because I was very convinced at the time, and I still feel this way, but I thought that God was, like, shaking me. Into changing a habit that I had gotten into. And like a lot of college stories, this was about a boy. But he was this kind of like, I mean, if we're going to tie this to Hosea, he was this kind of like, and in my mind, I always say Baal, but maybe it's Baal. Baal is how I say it. But he was this kind of thing to me. He was this, like, knowing disobedience. It was this kind of dalliance that was going on. And I was trying to think of, like, a current illustration, but, like, I put my kids in their room when they're bad doesn't really have the same, like, punch as jail. But, like, obviously my irresponsibility was, like, this overriding bad habit, but, like, I know that he was reaching in to my position right there and sort of saying, like, you need to wake up a little bit. I had been on and off dating him, and we'd been together, and then we weren't together, and I was still, like, hanging out with him and stuff. But I knew that this was not, you know, like I knew it was not the thing for me. And this was something that my roommates had like, tell me just like shaking their heads about, you know, like, this is not okay. Stop doing this. I had been praying about it. But it was still like, it was still happening. And so I was just trying to break this habit. And that's what I was doing that night, is that I was going over to his house. And so it felt like in this really real way that he was just like reaching in and plucking me off a path and like pinning me in a different place. You know, I was messing around with this thing a lot like Israel was messing around with this thing that I should not have been dabbling in. It was this flirtation that was bad for me, and God intervened in that situation. And God shook me with it. And I think that that is essentially like the purpose of exile in general, is to shake Israel. I saw real consequences for the stuff that had been going down. I mean, it was a lot of money at the time for me. And like, I didn't want to tell my parents about it. And so I was scrambling around trying to like fix this problem that I had like created for myself. But more than that, like it was embarrassing to me that like this thing that kind of in some ways felt like hidden and harmless didn't feel that way. It felt very exposed, and it felt more serious at the time. And I just felt like God knew what my heart was doing, and he was like, that's not okay. But in a beautiful way, you know, so I felt like the discipline of that, certainly. But in a beautiful way, I do feel like he reached in and said, I'm not going to let you hurt yourself like this anymore. And I would love to say that, one, you know, I grew up and I never ran a stop sign again. And two, that I dropped that guy for good. But that is not really what my story looked like. And it was very much like Israel also. But I do think that this thing, like looking back, that this thing was jump-started that progression. This was something that moved me down the line a little bit. And so it's not hard at all for me to identify with Gomer in Hosea. You know, and I think that our biggest takeaway here that we're going to talk about a little bit more is just that this conviction that he sees our actions and our thoughts and is not going to leave us to our own devices. And that plays out, I think, in a lot of different ways. Here in Hosea, we see God hedge in Israel for their protection from the idols and make great efforts to bring her home, and ultimately to use Christ to bring her home in a permanent kind of way, or bring us home in a permanent kind of way. And so as we read, we should be, I think that we should, of course, be asking about those times in your own life when God closed doors and maybe even embarrassed you, humiliated you, scared you, or shook you to open your eyes about something. Okay, so let's kind of pivot a little bit here, and let's talk about Hosea, and specifically kind of the lesson that we're supposed to do for this week. And so we're talking kind of about chapters 1-3 right now. And so chapters 1-3 tell Hosea's personal story, and this is really establishing like his credibility and his like persuasiveness, because we see what he has personally gone through, and so we hear him with a much which like with a really open mind and an open ear to what he has to say, and so we hear him like accusing and pleading with Israel over and over in this kind of spiral that happens throughout the book, and so Hosea's obedience and duty to like this kind of outlandish command to go marry a whore is what like gives him this credibility with us. And so we hear him in a receptive and sympathetic kind of way. And so the commentaries that I read said that Hosea was probably about 18 to 20 when he got married, and that kind of marks the beginning of his ministry. And then most people say that it was about 40 years long to the end of his ministry. And so he is commanding Hosea to take a wife of whoredom, Gomer, to illustrate how the men and women of Israel are unfaithful to Yahweh, and how he moves through this discipline and restoration with them. And what it does is it makes Israel's and our sin like very personal and specific, because we see it in the story of Hosea the man. And I do want to say, and I don't think that anybody would think this way about the book, but it certainly is not like a marriage how-to. God is not like commanding people to do the things that Hosea did. Like, this is a metaphor that we're talking about. I want to be like really clear that that is what's happening. But like in chapters 1-3, like Hosea's story is pretty sparse. So we would get some like kind of key details about what's going on, about the command, and about how Gomer is unfaithful, and about the three kids, and then how he like buys her back out of slavery and remarries her. But we don't really get like the nitty-gritty of what, like, their conversations looked like or what their relationship was like. We get, like, just a couple little states. We get, like, one statement from her and then just a few things specifically about Gomer out of the book. And it really, like, like, I'm really curious about this story. You know, like, what does this look like when you do these things? And even, you know, like, in chapters 1 through 3, even chapter 2 is where he is kind of doing this discipline with Gomer. But even that, like, he veers pretty quickly away from Gomer straight into Israel. And so, like, it's pretty thin what we really know about them. And so, like, I just was just curious about them. And so I thought a lot about, like, how does his duty and love play into this? How does that play into his obedience? You know, did he really love Gomer, or was he doing, was he just doing this out of duty to what God had commanded him to do? Did he love, eventually, Jezreel, no mercy, and not my people? Because what I hear him saying in chapter 3, essentially, is this kind of command to Gomer, come on, I need to use you and your sexuality to as a tool to teach somebody a lesson. And, like, to me, it's not super romantic thing to say. he clearly has a reason to be hardened to her. Like, that is, there's no doubt about that. But in some ways, he kind of sounds like a John himself in the way that he talks to her right there in that moment. This kind of God that would command and purchase loyalty and faithfulness out of duty without a tenderness. And I want you to hold that in your mind to when we talk about that at the end and compare that to Christ. And I would think that she would be grateful to be rescued from these circumstances, but without this, like, tenderness, I have to wonder, like, what did that sound like to her? And I also thought about Gomer a lot, you know, like, how old was she? Was she 14 years old? You know, like, how was she older than that? What kind of family did she come from? Did she want to be rescued? Did she want to marry Gomer? Did she see him, like, as this kind of sugar daddy? Did she feel like she was pulling one over on him? Were her children difficult? Was she bored? You know, like, what did their home look like? Did she ever feel guilty? And, like, at the end of the story, did she come to love him? And in my mind, like, I really, like, for the sake of, like, what this means, like, I really want her to have fallen in love with him. But we don't really get those details. And so the only time that we hear her voice is in chapter 2, in verse 5. And I just want to read that real quick. And we want to listen to this because this totally reveals, like, where she, at this point in her story, where she gets her identity, where she gets her value, and where she gets her sustenance. So chapter 5, or verse 5. For their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers who give me my bread, my water, my wool, and my flax, my oil, and my drink. Therefore, I will hedge her Therefore, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. And she shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but she shall not find them. And so we should, of course, be asking, like, if we're asking this about Gomer and we're seeing her make this statement about her identity and sustenance, okay, so, like, where do we get our identity and sustenance? Because the answer to that is probably where your idols are. You know, we're not going and sitting down at, like, a shrine to Baal, but there certainly are things in our lives that are providing those things and taking the place of where Christ should be for us. And, like, I don't need Jesus. I don't need Jesus and his forgiveness in theory. Like, I need that to be able to, like, walk through this door and be here. Because sometimes I think if you really knew me, you wouldn't want to have anything to do with me. And so this is it just feels so personal and, like, such an emotional, like, heart issue the whole time. All right, so let's kind of take this and let's zoom out a little bit from our lesson for this week and zoom out to the book of Hosea as a whole. And so the context that we're looking at, if you can see the map right there, but there's when the kingdom split, you can see up at the top, you see Israel, and then down at the bottom, the southern kingdom is Judah. And then go ahead and look at the next page. And there'll be some of those towns and stuff that get mentioned in the book. So, like, Samaria gets mentioned, and you can see where that is on the map. Also, just as an aside, Ephraim is talked about a lot. He will make mention of that, and that's just the largest tribe of Israel, and so he'll use that kind of as like a, not a euphemism, but like a synonym for Israel herself. And that's all that that is. It's just the largest tribe. And so as we're looking at this timeline, I love this thing. And so you can start up at the top at creation and just kind of tick down a little bit, and you see where the kingdoms divide. And so I think Israel is on the right side. Is that right? And then Judah goes to the left. And so if you look where the star is, and I have a big arrow pointing right there, and it shows you where Hosea is written. And so you can see that that is immediately before they're exiled to Assyria. And if you want to have, like, kind of to put this in context with Daniel, if you look over on the left side, you can see on on Judah's side, there is Daniel and when it was written. So just a touch after this. And then you can also, like, Christ is coming out of that line of Judah and stuff. And so this basic message that we hear in Hosea is coming, like, has been prophesied since Moses in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, that the northern kingdom of Israel has broken covenant and they will be exiled. And we see that come to pass. And Moses compares that to a man who is killed by the Lord. And then yet after this judgment and exile, God will save in the future as he has saved in the past. And so there's references to the Exodus and things coming in Hosea. And Moses, in his prophecy, compares that to a man resurrected. And obviously that image is really beautiful, since it's fulfilled in Christ. And Israel basically is living during Hosea's time, is living this life of its opposite to gospel faith. And they've been cheating on God with this this false god Baal, and they're looking for their identity and sustenance through that. And Hosea is warning them of what is coming. And so Hosea has this revulsion to the cult of Baal, and there's all these, like, gross things that are happening there. There's this ritual prostitution, there's child sacrifice. They're all about, it's a cult of fertility, and so there's a lot of credit. If they are fertile, they're giving credit to Baal, which is like a slap in the face to Yahweh, because obviously all their fertility is coming from him. And keep in mind this idea of fertility, because the book kind of closes with a pretty picture regarding that. But if you look down below that, you can see in this little graphic kind of the layout of the whole book. And so if you look at the bottom, you see where it says 1-3. And so that was our lesson for this week. That's chapters 1-3, and that's all about Hosea's marriage. And so we see Gomer's unfaithfulness, Gomer's discipline, and Gomer's restoration in what we talked about today. And then the rest of the study for this semester will be Hosea's message, and that's all about Israel. And so that, for the most part, you know, like chapters 4-13, we have these cycles of unfaithfulness, discipline, and restoration. And you see that happen, I think, 5 times in the course of those chapters. And then at the very end, in chapter 14, you have, like, this ultimate restoration, which is a really beautiful thing, and pointing towards Christ. Now, if you would like to look at the topical structure and chronological structure, I'm going to tell you just to go right ahead. I put that there if you're interested in those things, but we're not going to stop down on all that. But if you, it is really highly organized book, and so I think that's an interesting thing to see. But kind of the takeaway that I want us to have here, as far as the organization, is that you have this rhythm of judgment and salvation that happens again and again. And so you see that in this, like, microcosm of Hosea. We also see it in the whole of the Bible, that there is this ebb and flow between mercy and judgment. I think that we can even, like, pan out to creation, and I think you kind of see that symbolically in the seasons. I think that there's a lot of places in art, and you have this kind of common grace where this thing is a really archetypal idea of this ebb and flow between wilderness and haven. And you can think about David's story and a million other things. Moses' story, the idea of death and birth, the idea of exile, and then Exodus home. That there is, like, a punishment and then a welcoming home. And that home is Christ. Christ is the new home. Christ is the bridge to the new home. Christ is the sustenance on the sojourn. Like, he is all of those things. And so let's push down and pivot a little bit into Hosea's like emotional persuasion. And so the language and tone of what's happening in his book is really dense and really tragic. I mean, the subject is tragic, but the language he uses to describe it is really tragic also. It's emotionally intense. You have all these appeals to fear, to guilt, to anger, her children's influence on her, appeals to grief and disgust, all these, like, judgment kind of things. But also you see really beautiful flip side of that coin with appeals to joy and relief and love and safety. And those two things together heighten each other. And so one of the most like striking things about Hosea, I think, is that you get this like enormous, like it runs the gamut. You get the lowest of the low and get the highest of the high, and you feel the high because you saw the low. And it just wrings our hearts because it is so painfully real and gross. I think that it's a great, like, beautiful book. You have lots of artistic contrasts, and he uses that sometimes in really painful ways. But, like, this comparison and what we read this week of, like, exposure and nakedness versus being clothed with wool and flax and gold and silver, the contrast between thirst, like, and this sort of, like, gluttonous feasting. Oh, he uses metaphors and similes almost in every verse. The whole thing is just flooded with all these metaphors and similes. And some of them are really great. My favorite one that I read was that if you sow the wind, you will reap the whirlwind. And I'm thinking about using that around the house. But obviously the main metaphor is this idea of Gomer as a bride. But the secondary metaphor, one that he uses kind of in an extended way, is the metaphor of a son to a father. Or a child to the father. And I think what is really great about that is that he's picking those on purpose. Like these are, you can't get that same emotional like punch with like a shepherd and sheep, which is a beautiful picture, but it's not nearly as intense as a bride and a husband or a son and a father. It's not this like a king and his subjects, a judge with the defendants. Like those are all applicable and like enlighten us, but it's not the same intensity of what he does choose to use. Two other angles to kind of note here. Wanted to talk about prostitution kind of in literature throughout the ages. Prostitutes are very common in literature. They serve as really kind of convenient, like, symbols. Because, like, a reluctant prostitute is the ultimate damsel in distress. I mean, the only thing worse if you're a reluctant prostitute is if you were dead. And then a prostitute who is willing is kind of the ultimate femme fatale. She is using her sexuality as a tool against men, like, in a way that they find hard to resist, and it's something that they don't have in the same kind of way. And so I think what's really interesting about Gomer is that she behaves like a femme fatale, and she is treated like a damsel in distress. And so it's just like this reversal that we see in how she's treated. I remember Darwin at Fort Worth Prez talked about the Bible is essentially the story of the hero slaying the dragon and saving the girl. And I think that that kind of plays into our metaphor here, too. I also think that we at least have to touch down a little bit on prostitution as a reality, like in our community. And so I don't want to talk about this as a metaphor and not ever, like, mention that. I think that this should be something that we kind of have in the back of our minds, and that there are actual people, like, down the road who are buying and selling sex. I know that a lot of us were in a Bible study for a while with a woman who struggled with prostitution also, and so she was kind of in my mind too. this is hard to talk about. I taught a girl who became a stripper while I had her 2 different years, and the year like in between when I taught her, she became a stripper during that time. You know, so this is like 17 years old. And I've never seen a person's, like, character and identity, like, the look, like, her face, she changed, like, she was totally different. It was, like, it's just like a soul-callousing thing to do this business. It is a kind of slavery of, like, buying a person, or at least, like, their most intimate part that is just really, it's hard to think about. It's kind of horrifying. And what's also horrifying is that there's demand for it, which is worse. And because a lot of times the women who are doing this, you know, this is someone who has people, a lot of times has people to support, but does not have education or a network to, like, make that happen. And this is something that pays. And I wish that there were, I don't know, easier alternatives or something. But it certainly intensifies, like, as we read the book. Okay, let's talk about themes. And so because God is sovereign, idolatry is, like, absolutely prohibited, it's revolting, and it's just, like, silly. And I think that, like, you kind of see sometimes Hosea get a little bit sarcastic with all this because it doesn't make any sense to him. You know, like, why would you go over to this useless thing when you have Yahweh? B, because of God's sovereignty, all of life is under his control. And Hosea will go through these things. Fertility history, nationally, it's under his control. Internationally, it's under his control. He controls it all. And then I think that the biggest takeaway for me, that in essence, like, if you don't take anything else away from Hosea, I think it's the idea that God loves his people passionately. And whether that's the judgment speeches or the salvation speeches, like, you see his passion for his people. And that is the biggest takeaway. And so I wanted to talk about this idea of romance and relationship for just a second. You know, obviously we're Gomer. And God welcoming us home is like this really scandalous thing, that Christ is the one who is flayed by the lash of those salvation speeches so that I can enjoy the romance of the salvation speeches. He takes our shame and this kind of hiding over past Baals and over present idols too, and he replaces it with his righteousness, with his power. And he's living with us. And so what does, I like to think like through this symbolic way, so what does that mean like to me? What does a real kind of relational marriage look like with Yahweh? You know, what does that mean for me, for him to love me and for me to love him, and to be romanced by him like daily? And so we know Hosea is like this type of Christ, and Christ is the actual fulfillment of all this. And I think that chapter 11 is beautiful in showing us his love. And this is kind of a cheesy thing, but I think that, you know, Christ is coming from behind, from the most holy place, and he's like busting through the curtain to come out to us and basically like sit down on the couch with his arm around me, which is what my marriage looks like. And it's intimate and it's comfortable. And so I can't help, you know, like as I was thinking about this, I can't help but look at my own very flawed marriage. You know, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you all about Carter's like bad side. There's that. I'll tell you over here. Just kidding. I'll text you. So there's certainly that there. And so I'm not trying to stand up here and like give you advice, because I could tell you what not to do, but I don't know if I could tell you what to do. And it's messed up, but there are like good things about it. And so that's what I kind of want to touch on here. You know, how do I know him? I know him by listening to him. I know him by watching him. I know him by touching him. He knows me also by the way that I talk to him. I complain to him. I enlist his help. I laugh with him. I filter everything through him. I tell him stories. I cry with him. We process it all together. And I think that is best on our best days, you know. But in its best kind of way, like, I think that is a really good picture of how it should be with Christ. You know, with Carter, like, there's this ebb and flow. And there is wilderness and haven, and there is conflict and resolution. And, you know, honestly, if you would have asked me, like, a year ago, if I could stand up and say, like, really good things, like, I don't know if I would have been much in the mood to do that. But it is miraculously resilient, also. And, you know, I've seen him be my angel when I was in the pit, and I have seen him like slay dragons, even dragons like within himself, to be with me and to make this work. And I think that is a really beautiful way to think about our relationship with Christ. And I want us to be emotional. It's an emotional book. Like, I want us to be emotional about all this. And he has a really endearing habit. Again, he's not perfect, but he has a really sweet habit about telling me that I'm pretty in really heartfelt ways. And the thing that's amazing to me about this is, you know, he says it when I'm, like, cleaned up, got my clothes on, I'm showered, and I'm, you know, fit to be in public. But he also, like, I would say, like, equally says those things when I am, like, objectively, if not okay. You know, we're, like, on day 4 of no shower, there's, like, pimples, and there's something crusty, who knows what's crusty on my shirt. Like, those things that, like, I am, like, point blank, like, not. And so, and, like, it's not that I look good. It's not that I look beautiful. It is his eyes that see me that way. You know, Sally Lloyd-Jones says in the Storybook Bible that we are lovely because he loves us. And I think that is exactly what is happening with Carter, and certainly what's happening with Christ, that Christ makes that a reality for us. And Hosea ends with a love song that is compared to Song of Solomon a little bit. And it basically said, you know, there's a lot of fertility talk in Hosea, and this sounds like a garden being regenerated. It's like a reversal. It's this Garden of Eden kind of feeling here at the end, that I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall blossom like the lily. He shall take root like the trees of Lebanon. His shoots shall spread out. His beauty shall be like the olive, and his fragrance like Lebanon. Carter and I got married really quickly, like first date in December, honeymoon in July, kind of quickly. This is old Beth at work again, but it worked out. I mean, I would totally like lose my mind if my kids did it. But the picture at the bottom is us dancing to our first, like our first song, you know, our song. And it's this quirky little like indie pop song called Nothing Matters When We're Dancing. It's real like plucky on a ukulele or something. But the words go, nothing matters. And I sing like a bullfrog, so there's no way I was going to sing this. But nothing matters when we're dancing. In tattered tatters, you're entrancing. Be we in Paris or in Lansing. Nothing matters when we're dancing. And so who is this God that like not only like loves me in my tatters, but like transforms my tatters? And he doesn't just like see me as cleaned up. He cleans me up. Who is this God who sees my actions and my thoughts and is not going to leave me to my own devices? And so what we see here, this threat of impending exile, it doesn't apply to us anymore if we are in Christ, that we are looking towards home. And we married up in like this cosmic kind of way, and he's too much. And I'm so glad to study him and to worship him with y'all this semester. Amen.